The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Jerry Barnett is an author, technologist, campaigner, photographer, and entrepreneur. With a long background in anti-fascism campaigning, he has become increasingly disillusioned with the new left, which has taken on many of the attitudes and methods of the old right. His book, Porn Panic, is out from Zero Books this month. It's Friday, August 19th, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. In this episode, you'll hear a collage. You'll also hear some pornographic music from the 70s, an excerpt from Kate Brooks' debate with Brennan O'Neill and Peter Hitchens. She was debating against the proposition that free speech includes the right to offend. And a clip from Tony Bambino's Lounge Club cover of the Internationale. Right now, you're listening to Sexopolis by Jean-Pierre Miroz. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Jerry Barnett and I discuss his book, Porn Panic. Jerry Barnett is a campaigner for free expression and the founder of Sex and Censorship. Jerry's political activism began in the late 1970s when he became involved with Rock Against Racism and the Anti-Nazi League. His book, Porn Panic, is due out from Zero Books in August. Jerry, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks for inviting me.
Your book is coming out in August. It's called Porn Panic, and the first thing I noticed about it was how well organized it was. So you've got a chapter entitled How Anti-Sex Feminism Was Born, a chapter on the suppression of the female body, a chapter on free expression. But then there's this chapter that wasn't like the others. It's this chapter, The Trouble with Winning. That chapter really isn't about sex or porn at all. And it's not, I don't even think it's really about winning. But it's about how liberal values and the left parted ways in the late 20th century.
That's right. And I felt it needed a run-in from, it's quite a personal book to some extent. It's about my own journey on the left and then from the left and kind of having, you know, witnessed through my own experiences what's happened to the left. And I wanted to kind of put into context, the book is about, to some extent, the collapse of the left. And I wanted, the trouble with winning is to set the scene to explain why I think the left collapsed. And then before I go on to the narrate how it collapsed and in what way and then it's, you know, it's a narrative, you know, beginning to end. But I felt the scene needed to be set, and the introduction is very much, you know, before that is very much about my past on the left and the fact that to an extent I come from a kind of a long left-wing lineage. My grandfather was a Jewish communist in the 1930s, who, you know, an anti-fascist campaigner. And to an extent, that's the political lineage I come from. Mm-hmm. I was kind of very much, I grew up with left-wing royalty to an extent in the 1980s. London was a real fascinating place to be young and left-wing back then. Things like the ANC was based in London, and a lot of revolutionary groups from around the world were based in London. And as a having a left-wing upbringing around those people as a teenager was fascinating. So yeah, I'm kind of, it's to an extent it's a personal story, and it's a story of how I noticed what had happened on the left and then tried to characterize what was happening. The chapter after that, I haven't got the contents open in front of me, but I think the chapter after that, I think, is the one on anti-sex feminism.
Right.
And which is really where the left, sections of the left, begin to go into league with the religious right and do very weird things. And I think I really pinpoint the 70s or the kind of early mid-70s as the point where it all goes wrong. And I think the reason I called it The Trouble with Winning was that to an extent the movement had achieved its goals. So, you know, especially from a British perspective, we have the achievement of a huge social democratic revolution in the 1940s, mm-hmm. which brought about our national health service, our welfare state, universal education, and so on. And then a liberal revolution in the 1960s. And those two strands really were really the pinnacle of the left's achievements in hindsight. And, you know, it is very much in hindsight, because when I got involved as a teenager in the late 70s, early 80s, we thought still we were about to witness the revolution. It was kind of one last push to the socialist revolution. Mm-hmm. And actually, it had already peaked. We were already nostalgic for something that was no longer in existence. And that's much clearer now, 30 years later, than it was then.
I view the period of time after the Second World War as a time where, because of an economic boom, things were possible in terms of creating capitalism with a human face or, you know, social democracy, that began to be less easily done later on in the 70s, 80s, you know, in the period that is called neoliberalism, and that we're still struggling with today. I don't think that social democracy has secured itself firmly because of the tendency for capitalism to go into crisis. These things are always threatened. Certainly in England or in the UK now, the NHS seems to be on the chopping block again.
The UK situation, especially after World War II, was very different from the US situation. So we weren't in an economic boom. We were absolutely economically crucified at that point. And despite that, we created a national health service and a welfare state and so on. It must be said with the help of large loans from the United States. But in terms of living standards in the UK, you know, I think we there was a fairly continuous progression from, I mean, absolute, you know, dire poverty in a lot of cases in the 30s and 40s, and then, you know, and progressing onwards. I mean, I guess that's not so different from with the US. In terms, I mean, I think we have to take care with kind of party political narratives over social democracy. I mean, our left and right wings are now so close to some extent that the huge battles we have are often over, you know, increasing or decreasing GDP spending by a couple of points of GDP. So what happens, you know, every time we have a conservative government, they squeeze the NHS a bit and the left complains that it's dying. And then whenever we have a Labour government, they increase funding again. But I think in practice the NHS has been somewhat squeezed by the Conservatives. There isn't, not to the extent that it was by the Thatcher government, say in the 1980s. And to an extent, nobody dares attack the NHS to any great degree. I think one of the feelings I've had in recent years is that the left in the UK, for sure, left and right, have become two slightly modified versions of social democracy. You know, where one pushes control a bit back to the state, and one pushes control a bit back to the free market. But you know, nobody would dare try to unravel the NHS as it is now, and I feel, you know, that the narratives are a lot louder than the realities.
Particular case, we just got along very well. There's a friendship.
Do you all?
But the problem with this is that the Great Depression is what led to the boom
a Marxist would say, Great Depression was what led actually to the revitalization of capitalism in the 40s and the 50s, the 60s, is that so much capital was destroyed both in war and as from the crash of the economy that people were able to buy the capital stock so cheap now they make mega profits. And so we had this, you know, the golden period of US capitalism. But now...
I like things that are well designed. This box is interesting and practical. Would you recommend Marlboro?
Creative destruction occurs in all kinds of industries today. Some individuals might be made worse off, not just in the short term, but perhaps throughout their lives. But he also knew that without creative destruction, that our economies would stagnate and we would never experience the growth and higher living standards that this process entails.
I would call myself a social democrat today rather than a socialist, and I would call myself a small L libertarian or a classical liberal or whatever. So I wouldn't say I particularly departed from the left. I wrote a blog post, I think, with the title a couple of years ago. The title put it better than I am now. The title was, I never left the left, the left left me. And it's not so much that many of my views have shifted greatly, but it's that I actually find... the left actually quite vile in a lot of ways. That the people that make it up and the narratives that it's kind of unfolding. So I think economically, I've definitely moderated, and I'm very much an economic centrist these days. But in terms of the social kind of policies, I was always very much an anti-fascist and anti-racist campaigner. And I've noticed really very recently within the past 3-4 years that there's, while right-wing racism, what we used to know, that the kind of far right has really fizzled out. It really has very little power in the UK anymore. There is a really horrible kind of new forms of racism, new forms of bigotry arising on the left. And I know a lot of these get talked about more broadly, but, you know, certainly the ideas like white privilege and like cultural appropriation, I find deeply racist, fascistic even. And it angers me and upsets me that these ideas are coming from the left. And when I look at the people actually making up the left, you know, Britain had an incredibly strong labor movement. The left, the British left was born out of the British labor movement. That kind of collapsed really in the 80s as neoliberalism and the, you know, Reaganomics and Thatcherism kind of took root. And the left today is a different thing. It's different people. it's much more middle class. It's much whiter. And at the point, I think one of the core key points I make in the book really is that the left has really absorbed fascist ideas. Not that they're not immediately recognisable as fascism, because we're used to thinking of fascism as screaming skinheads and white supremacists, and you know those that's the kind of fascism I grew up with. But this is real fascism, I think, that's taken over large sections of the left, attacks on equality, attacks on reason, and attacks overall on free expression, so I guess, I think the left to a large extent has left me.
The attack on reason, you would characterize that as a fascist move?
Yeah, well, I tried to kind of be more careful in the book. So I talk about enlightened values, primarily those three. By reason, I really mean science and technological progress. Mm-hmm. And this is, the left was certainly very much twinned in the past, very enthusiastic about technological progress. Right. There's a real strong anti-science movement growing on the left, and again, that's unexpected. But so by reason, I mean science more than anything.
What do you think the culprit is? Why has the left changed? And is it that the left is holding on to an agenda which no longer makes sense because it still has this radical ambition to change society when, in fact, social democracy is the change that we need. We're tilting at windmills here.
I think I'll leave the economic side to one side because, okay, to an extent, it's two separate arguments. Uh-huh. There's the, you know, and this is a point I make early in the book. The old left was a kind of alliance between socialism and liberalism. Mm-hmm. And what the book's really about is the death of liberalism, and especially the death of liberalism on the left. So, I mean, part of the answer is that liberalism appears to be in decline pretty broadly across the political spectrum. That, you know, that's kind of a frightening thing. But it's also that the left, large sections of the left, have taken aim at liberalism and are trying to dismantle it. So, you know, the war on equality, you know, the book looks at feminism a lot because the book is about sexual expression more than anything else. Yeah. And it was really, this really came into my own consciousness because I was a technologist and I was running online porn sites on the internet. Mm-hmm. 10 years or so ago. And the whole thing of the anti-sex feminism thing came into my consciousness. And that was really my first contact with what you might call the fascist left. I don't like to use the expression because I start to sound like a kind of a right-wing.
Or you could call it the regressive left that's sometimes used. But again, these are right-wing terms. Yeah.
Yeah. I try not to sound too right-wing, but it becomes hard sometimes. Hard.
Okay. But I get stuck on this economics thing. I'm big into it. So let me see if I can put this aside. The project for socialism and real deep political economic change, that's not an issue anymore. The question now is, why are we attacking the culture of liberalism or the values of liberalism? And it doesn't really have to do with whether or not we succeeded in our real ambitions or not, or whether or not you want to hold on to some sort of socialist vision or not. Even if you don't hold on to the socialist vision, a lot of people who don't hold on to it are still attacking liberal values.
The two strands do need to be separated, but I mean, we have. I travel to the US a lot over the last 25 years or so, especially through the 90s, and I've seen the visible poverty in the US is far deeper and far more shocking than what we have in the UK. You know, prior to the crash in 2008, we reached a point where poverty was, you know, as we'd seen it in previous decades, was virtually gone, you know, at least, especially to the extent that you would see it in the US, that, you know, because we have a national health service, because we have a decent universal education system, and so a decent welfare state. We got to the point where left-wing commentators, you know, 10 years ago were saying, you know, the only people who are really suffering poverty in this country are refugees, and that's because we're not treating them very well. So there were huge gains. The other thing is that my partner is of Nigerian background. I've spent a lot of time traveling in West Africa, and I've become aware that the left-wing narrative of neoliberal doom doesn't really fit what's been happening in the poor world. So, you know, Africa, Asia, especially, have just seen massive, massive reductions in poverty that just didn't fit. You know, when the Berlin Wall fell, you know, we on the left just felt so pessimistic because it even though we might not have been very pro-USSR, it felt like that was a bulwark against the ravages of global capitalism. And that just didn't come to pass, I don't think.
When I felt like when the Berlin Wall fell, it was a great victory for the left. But, you know, maybe that was a tough sell, but that's how
I felt. Well, as a Trotskyist, my head said, this is good, the evil Stalinist empire has gone away. And my heart said, this huge experiment in socialist economics, however messed up and distorted it may have been, is gone. And now we're going to have capitalism everywhere and there's going to be no bulwark against capitalism. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we Trotskyists were supposed to believe that Stalinism would fall and be replaced by democratic socialism, but it didn't. That didn't happen.
Arise, ye workers, from your slumber. Arise, you prisoners of want. That's right. For reason in revolt now thunder. Chains of hatred, greed, and fear. Ha ha! Away with all your superstitions. Serve our masses. Arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition and spurn the dust to win the prize. So comrades, come on and rally. Then the last fight, let us face. The international unites the whole darn human race. So comrades, come on, let's go rally. And the last fight, let us face. The international unites the whole darn human race.
We're still sort of talking about socialism and the left in terms of a kind of a radical utopian project to change the base of society. It was still kind of floating in the background here. But you're talking not about that. You're talking about embracing fascist values and attacking liberal values within capitalism. So why is that happening?
I identify it in the book as really what I call counter-enlightenment is probably a more accurate term than fascism. Mm-hmm. Fascism is an instance of counter-enlightenment. So, I mean, why? I'm not quite sure. I mean, maybe this is a cycle, you know, maybe this is an 80-year thing that every now and then we turn against liberal values and attack them. I mean, as I say, I think there has certainly been a decline in liberal values across society. I think the book is more. Sorry, I got myself slightly tangled, but I'm identifying in particular a rise of what I call fascist or counter enlightenment values on the left, and I think that's the thing that shocked me, because I think in the US you use the words liberal and left wing almost interchangeably. We've never really done that here.
Yeah.
So we've always had a liberal party in the center ground, and then kind of socialists and social democrats to the left, and conservatives and free market people to the right. I think what I've charted is there was a high watermark of liberalism in the end of the 60s. Part of the reason I look at porn was obviously because I was involved with it and I found it very interesting. But part of it is because it's very much the canary in the coal mine. Do you have that expression in America?
Yes.
Okay. It's very much a really useful measure of what's happening with free expression. So when about 10 years ago, there was a real upsurge in anti-porn, anti-strip club, anti-sexual imagery. That kind of took me by surprise, and I happened to be at the forefront of that. But it was kind of going in there and starting to be involved. I had friends who were strippers and whose clubs were being shut down. And all of a sudden, the people attacking the strippers were feminists, mm-hmm. trade unionists, members of the Labour Party, you know, the people that I considered my people. And then on the fringes, there was a particular anti-sex feminist group called Object, which I document in the book, which is effectively a hate group and which actually set out to attack and vilify sex workers in the most fascistic and horrible ways. Sorry, I think I've rambled a bit from the point there.
When are we talking about here, when this was happening? Is this the 80s that we're looking at, in the 70s?
There's quite an abrupt change. So I think the 90s, at least in the UK, was a very liberal time. There, you know, once the Thatcher era was over, everything became there was this kind of new summer of love feel, especially in the early 90s. There was the rise of dance music culture and ecstasy, which kind of very, very much mirrored the hippies and the LSD of the 1960s. There was a disengagement from politics. There was a massive decline in racism, very, very visible, very quickly, a massive decline in homophobia. I mean, in the 90s, in London, you suddenly started seeing men holding hands in the street, something you'd never seen before. This, you know, this huge social liberalism that led to the election of the Blair government, which was at the time seen as a progressive government. And Mary Whitehouse was kind of our Christian, the Christian crusader against everything. We don't really have much of a religious right in this country, but Mary Whitehouse embodied the religious right. And she had been going since the 60s. By the 90s, she was a laughing stock. She was just a silly old woman and no one took her seriously. And it was a real revolutionary kind of era in a really low-key, fun way. She died in 2001. And to me, that marks the end of the old conservatism. But then very rapidly after 2001, there was the rise of the new left-wing conservatism. So I mark the rise of the conservative left to the early parts of this century. And they certainly started trying to close down strip clubs and things. I think their campaign began about 2002-03, and that movement has really snowballed and gathered speed ever since then. I call it the porn panic because that's the first part of it I noticed, and I think that was the first part that anyone noticed. But that's now expanded out into the movement that gets talked about a lot more, of no platform in universities, of kind of safe spaces, and this idea that free speech has become a dirty word on the left. I mean, quite literally, on Twitter, left-wing activists started writing "freeze peach," so like the word "freeze" as in frozen, and "peach," so basically anyone defending free speech from about literally only 2-3 years ago, suddenly you would get attacked by left-wing people who would say, "You can't, free speech is all very well because you're a white male, but you know it's not so fun if you're a trans person or a woman or whatever." And so it's the rise of identity politics that's the real nasty thing that's happened to the left, I think.
In the United States in the 90s, we had our own version of Blair. It was Bill Clinton, and people were so pleased to see the Reagan administration end, but it didn't end until 92. And I was going to university in the early 90s, and I was actually working on the left. I was in an environmental organization called Osberg, and that organization was dominated by left-wing feminists who were very concerned about pornography as an attack on women. And at that time, there was a book called American Psycho that became a movie later. My friends at the Oregon's Public Interest Research Group were calling to ban or boycott.
Yeah, which I thought was a great indictment of Wall Street capitalism, really, wasn't it?
Yeah. But my feminist friends at the time thought it was called it a how-to manual on how to rape and murder women. You know, that's what they said it was, even though it wasn't a how-to manual at all. And it was a novel. And so it seems to me this goes back further than
it does. Yeah, and I trace this in the book. I think chapter 3 is the birth of anti-sex feminism, and that was very much born in the United States. That was very much an American movement. And even though Britain and the US do kind of rhyme in our patterns, we don't always go in the same direction at the same time. The anti-sex feminists, kind of led by Andrea Dworkin and Catherine MacKinnon, they really kind of surfaced in the late 1970s. And they established, I identified them as being more responsible than anyone else for establishing left-wing language for doing right-wing things, if you like. So they teamed up with the religious right to attack pornography. And I think they were very influential, but I don't think that movement really hopped the Atlantic to any great extent until really maybe 15 years ago. So even though you would have had anti-sex feminists here reading Dworkin and so on, but I think that the surge in that movement really is much more recent in the UK.
So how did it get to the UK? Why was it suddenly popular in the early 2000s, at the turn of the millennium?
9/11 marked a real change in global politics everywhere. I think it definitely closed in Britain. It closed the door on a very liberal decade, and for many years, I think I blamed 9/11 and then Bush and Iraq and Blair for creating this new conservative atmosphere. Maybe they were just a symptom of it.
Bush represented something completely different than Blair, right?
Yeah.
So in the United States, Bush was a return of Reaganism. There was this feeling that to have Bush back in the White House was a major step back. It was a very contentious election that brought him into power. And then, so he was a weak president, really, until after 9/11. The attacks of 9/11 kind of changed the situation entirely. And the fact that two leaders who were, for their people and ideologically, not the same.
No, not at all.
Blair was, that they could completely unify around this.
And Blair was an interesting character. I mean, I think he was kind of an ideological blank slate to an extent. He doesn't seem to be deeply ideological in any in any way. But
and that was the truth about Clinton, too. For us, that was the truth about Clinton. Clinton was not an ideological president, even though he came in after Reagan and we kind of all pinned our hopes for a progressive future onto him. He turned out to be very pragmatic and not like Blair. That's the common wisdom anyway on these guys. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, Blair was, he was a kind of Clinton, but Blair headed a fairly left-wing, by American standards, Labour government. And while Blair was kind of out playing with foreign adventures, then actually at home we had a very progressive government. The NHS was massively refunded. Pretty much every school and hospital that I knew in London was demolished and rebuilt. So... It was a great government from an economic point of view. Housing, homelessness fell, unemployment fell. Absolutely, Blair was an anomaly over here. We hate him for it still. You know, the fact that he went and gave Bush shelter, back to the original kind of point. It was. The party was over. You know, the 90s was like a party, and whether it was 9/11 or just simply shifts that happened around that time, there's this kind of sour conservative kind of era grew as a result. And over here, at least, the far right was the original, was the first beneficiary of 9/11. Kind of anti-Muslim sentiment grew, the old fascist groups kind of grew again. There were the fascist street movements reappeared, like the English Defence League and the British National Party. And so my own campaigning work until maybe four or five years ago was very much focused on the fascism that I recognised, these kind of far right, white working class, disenchanted movements. And then literally very quickly in the space, 3-4 years ago, I began to realize that these movements were kind of powerless. They were formed of disenfranchised, angry working class people. And actually there was a much more powerful fascism growing on the political left, which had its roots in parts of the Labour Party and parts of the trade union movement, in local authorities. And the Blair government itself, even though we didn't really notice at the time, was a very authoritarian government. They introduced a lot of new laws, and they introduced these things called ASBOs. I don't know if you've heard of this idea.
No, go ahead. What is it?
An ASBO is an antisocial behavior order. So they basically allowed the police to criminalize people who hadn't broken the law. So, for example, you could have an ASBO for playing your music too loud, and the police, you could then get a ban on playing music again. And then if you played music again, you were then criminalized and you could then end up in prison. So there was a big upsurge in authoritarianism that we on the left kind of overlooked because we kind of liked our government at the time.
You weren't breaking a sound ordinance or something like that, or a noise ordinance when you played your music too loud?
No, an ASBO could be for anything, literally anything. It could be for having sex too loud, and I think there was one or two cases of that. You know, it could be, the idea was to, you know, again, to an extent it was a progressive, it came from a progressive place because it was often aimed at council estates, what you call projects, I think. So it was kind of in poorer communities, people in social housing who by and large couldn't move away from violent neighbors or noisy neighbors or neighbors who threw trash in the streets or whatever. The idea was to make life better for poor people in social housing. And I think to an extent it did its job, but it also gave the police a massively powerful tool to criminalize anyone for any behavior that might be seen as antisocial. And at the same time, free speech, attacks on free speech began. So we have the Communications Act 2003 outlaws the sending of malicious communications. And we now have people arrested pretty much on a daily basis for sending abusive tweets, for example. Stuff that, I mean, this kind of thing that would be step way over the line of the First Amendment in the United States. You know, it's the attacks on free speech that I'd be most concerned of in the last few years.
So what you're really saying is that, not that we're trying to silence you, but that we have the audacity to try and erode the platform that our racist and misogynistic society has given to two privileged white men. That is what we are guilty of doing. What you are saying is you personally have a right to that platform, which other people are not given, that you personally should maintain hegemony over that platform. What we are saying is move the hell over. Other people deserve that platform. Other people who are not white, who are not men, and who are not of the people that you call privileged. Move over. And in order to do that, you have to create a space where those people can actually enter into that discourse.
You have this chapter entitled The Big Panic.
Yeah, that's where I kind of anatomize. This is where I started paying real close attention to attacks on free expression. And so I anatomize kind of blow by blow. I call it The Big Panic because it's not a moral panic. There is moral panics after moral panic after moral panic, one after the other, just attacking expression in any way, shape, or form. So I identified the start of this era as August 2011, which was when we had the riots in the UK. And straight away, the police and the government came out and blamed social media. And they, David Cameron spoke to Twitter and BlackBerry and told them he wanted a kill switch. And they told him to get lost, and that's really when social media, Facebook, Twitter, and just abusive speech, kind of unpleasant speech, suddenly got into the headlines and suddenly became beyond unacceptable. You know, so being rude to people online began to become unacceptable, and then because the feminist movement. The kind of the pro-censorship feminist movement had already built around the anti-porn campaigns.
Yeah,
they very quickly stepped in there. So what we have today is that most of the attacks on online free speech are typically around the buzzword misogyny, and so misogyny has become kind of online misogyny has become this huge deadly plague which suddenly appeared out of nowhere. The implication being that the internet is turning nice people into horrible women-hating people. And so you have this kind of feminist veneer justifying censorship of everything, pretty much. I wrote a blog post the other day, you know, The Guardian, which is traditionally been a liberal paper, has been increasingly intolerant to free expression. It joined the anti-porn bandwagon very early, and now it's joined the anti-misogyny, I'll put misogyny in quotes there, because, you know, bandwagon. And so, yeah, I mean, you have this very, very authoritarian kind of feminist-led movement against free speech. And their argument is that anywhere that misogyny happens, the state must intervene to stop it. And because misogyny happens everywhere where speech happens, then all speech must be regulated to protect women. It's a very, very conservative message. And it seems to be kind of spiraling upwards at the moment. It's blowing up very, very quickly.
Do you think that there is a problem at all online? Are women more likely to be attacked online or insulted online?
No, I mean, they're simply not. And research shows that they're not. And this narrative comes from an older feminist narrative about violence where, I mean, we all know, you know, you go to any country in the world and men are more likely to experience serious violence than women. Men are, in the UK, are about twice as likely to be murdered as women. And that's a fairly consistent statistic. Men are more violent than women, and men tend to target men more than women. And the statistics for Twitter and so on show that's that same, which I think is fairly, it's primitive human behavior, continues online. So most of the abusers are men, and most of the abuse is directed at men. The difference being that online is speech, whereas offline is violence. The kind of pro-censorship feminist movement has tried to blur the line between speech and violence by calling online speech cyber violence. So now we have cyber violence against women on Twitter. In a nutshell, there isn't evidence of massive online misogyny. Men are more likely to be targeted. But there is this very conservative feminist analysis that basically says that it's worse when women are targeted than when men are targeted. And of course, this isn't a feminist message at all. This is an anti-feminist message. Certainly a women's lib era feminist would recoil at the idea that it's worse to swear at a woman than to swear at a man.
The people who are spearheading these movements to protect women online, say, against misogyny, are often divisive or controversial figures themselves. And so they end up receiving quite a lot of hate mail.
Yeah, I think you might be thinking of Anita Sarkeesian.
I'm thinking of her, yeah. But there are others. But yeah, Anita Sarkeesian is the big one, who's seemingly has made sort of a career on having been the target of so many vicious attacks.
Yeah, I mean, she's interesting. She's a lucrative career. And, you know, I mean, she originally came out with a piece of fairly, what I believe is fairly shoddy research, in which she said that gaming was a misogynist art form.
Yeah, I mean, have you watched those videos? You have, clearly, right?
Her videos.
Yeah.
I've watched some. I don't really look at in that much detail.
They're kind of boilerplate feminist analysis of media. It just applied to video games. So it's, you know, and sometimes misapplied ideas like the male gaze, which comes from Lacanian psychoanalysis and film theory, applied very crudely to video games. But it's not as though the work that she's doing is particularly unique. You know,
I got the impression she doesn't come across as a particularly groundbreaking in any way until, as you just said, what made her famous wasn't her work. It was the fact that she got abused for her work. And I mean, as I understand, she got some fairly horrible and disgusting abuse on Twitter, and you know, but she then springboarded from that to become a global feminist icon. And I in the book I look at a similar case of Caroline Criado Perez, who was abused on Twitter. It's a much smaller case, but it kind of illustrates how this works. She was abused on Twitter, not nearly to the scale Sarkeesian was, It turned out that her two abusers, the media reported a torrent of rape threats and abuse coming from thousands of abusers. And it turned out that virtually all the abuse came from two individuals. They were arrested because we don't have a First Amendment here. They were arrested and eventually went to prison. It was a young man and a young woman, both kind of working class, unemployed, probably, at least in the case of the woman, mental health issues. But those two people form the basis of a narrative that women are unsafe online. And so we have this cherry picking of examples used to create a general point that women are unsafe online and we must censor the internet.
I don't think that even in the United States, a direct rape threat is protected speech.
Yeah, I think the rape threat is a largely mythical thing. And I've only seen one instance, and it wasn't actually a threat. It was a comment along the lines of, I hope you get raped, or raping will be too good for you, or something. So it wouldn't strictly be called a threat. But yeah, I mean, there were horrible people directing horrible messages at Inisa Sarkeesian and Caroline Criado Perez. But that narrative, I kind of trace it, as I say, from the riots in 2011 to, I think, Sarkeesian and Criado Perez was maybe 2012-13. And then this drumbeat on and on and on that free speech is bad, free speech is dangerous, free speech hurts women, which is still growing to this day. And as I say, The Guardian has been very proactive in building this as well.
And the argument that people give on the left about free speech is that there is no real equality in speech?
Yeah, right? So we then get into identity politics. So free speech is okay. Basically, free speech can't be handed out equally because white men have all the power, and therefore, we all need to be censored because white men abuse their free speech to abuse minorities. And it's the identity politics aspect, which I think is the most, as I said, the most fascistic part of all. And because I have such a long background in anti-racism, I think the bit that I understand the most, that what they've done is they've taken a far right fascist narrative from 30 years ago and just flipped it to make it sound progressive.
What was that narrative 30 years ago? How would it be expressed then?
Again, race kind of works very differently here than in the US. We have a very different history, but the far right narrative here originates from the fascists of the 1930s, and it's always expressed in kind of fascist terms, and it is very much a white working class thing. And I think the left that I was involved with in the 80s, we bridged the gap between non-white communities and white communities that had been lured by fascism, and very quickly we bridged and broke down the divisions. But that's because we don't have a racially segregated society. It's a very different situation from America.
30 years ago, when if this was on the lips of fascists in the UK, it would have been, instead of saying, well, free speech isn't equal between people because white men have too much power and need to be censored because they're abusing us, it would have been the opposite. It would have been,
censorship narrative doesn't directly translate, but the identity politics underlying it does. So the idea that you might exclude someone for being black 30 years ago, I mean, that was not acceptable even then. But today, today in a university, and this has happened, you'll have someone put a sign on the door of a meeting saying no white men. So, it's the worst kind of excesses of white racism of 30, 40, 50 years ago are now translated against white people and against men. And the white privilege narrative I find particularly obnoxious because if you take a kind of socialist, a Marxist analysis, what united black and white communities in the UK was their common poverty, their common problems with police violence, common problems with housing, and so on. And that was, you know, it was the left that united those communities. We didn't say that, you know, it was quite clear that black people suffered those things disproportionately, but that's not the same as saying they suffered them. There's a very different history here. And again, if you go back to the speeches of Martin Luther King and this kind of thing, there was an awareness in the civil rights movement too that white poverty, you know, being white and poor was no more fun than being black and poor. There was the kind of white privilege analysis just blurs statistics to say, you know, black people on average are more poor than white people. Therefore, all white people are privileged and all black people are oppressed. And you end up with these ludicrous these ludicrous conclusions coming out of that.
I mean, just to play devil's advocate, which I guess I've been doing in a way all along in different ways, I don't feel that as a white person, as a white man, my freedom of speech is truly suppressed. It certainly isn't comparable to, say, the freedom of movement that I would have felt and suffered under segregation in the South,
yeah,
you know, in the 60s and 50s. It's just nowhere comparable. And the reason why is because you're talking about a couple of feminists on universities putting a sign up on a door rather than an institutionalized...
So don't get me wrong. I'm not worried about white men having their free speech removed. What I'm worried about is the identity politics narrative being used to remove free speech from everybody. And that's happened before. I mean, when we have the no platform thing in the UK, I don't know if that's as common in the US.
It's very common here, yeah.
Okay, and that began in the 1970s, supposedly against fascists, but then it was very quickly used against black nationalist groups. So, you know, we know the slippery slope of censorship. You pick the easiest target, and it just happens to today the easiest target is white men. I'm not in any way in suggesting that white men are having their free speech attacked more than anyone else, except that you're more likely to get abused on Twitter. It's kind of more acceptable to abuse you on Twitter as a white man than anything else. But no, I think there is a war on free speech, and it happens that it's being sold under a kind of very thin progressive veneer of protecting black people and protecting women and protecting trans people and so on. The laws and the regulations against free speech will apply to everyone and probably hit minorities worse than they do white people.
Your book is actually, you know, it's on these big issues, free speech and identity politics, but it's also about porn. Mm-hmm. And I feel like as a marketer, I would be remiss if I didn't talk about porn a little bit here. You have a chapter called 40,000 Years of Porn. My understanding is that porn as a category really is pretty new. So Victorian values created pornography as a concept, but that sexual expression and art has been around forever.
I say 40,000 years of porn slightly playfully, but however, I make the point in that chapter that we tend to put a nice spiritual wrapping around ancient stuff. So, you know, where we find kind of 40,000 year old carvings or ceramics of kind of highly sexualized female figures, we might call them fertility symbols or talk about kind of, the mother goddesses and this kind of thing. But actually it's pretty likely that they had some kind of masturbatory use and that they were valued for that purpose. We don't know. And, you know, so as the old saying goes, what you like is pornography, what I like is erotica. And, there is no real line between porn and erotica. It's in you know, how disgusted it makes you feel. And, you know, we have become, it has become normalized. I think that's a good thing. And we are far more things that most people wouldn't be shocked by today. We might have been shocked by if we saw 30 years ago. But the other point I make in the chapter is that sexual freedom and political freedom tends to go rise and fall hand in hand. And actually, it's much easier for authoritarians to attack sexual freedom and sexual expression than it is to attack political speech. But the end result is inevitably that once you accept that the state is empowered to censor something, the state will end up censoring what it wants to. So it's about porn and sexual freedom, and it's about political freedom, and I think the two are inseparable. And then later in the book, again, I have a chapter on the harms. So again, looking at, is porn harmful, and reviewing the evidence on that. And, you know, there is a vast amount of evidence, especially statistical evidence, that suggests that not only is porn not harmful, its availability appears to be pretty beneficial to society in a lot of ways. And I think that argument, it's important to make that argument because, you know, sexual expression is always at the leading edge of attacks. And one suspects that's happened throughout history. There was an exhibition of erotic Roman art at the British Museum a couple of years ago, and I listened to a podcast where they interviewed the curator, and they said, the interviewer said, well, most of this imagery seems to be male imagery. And he said, we've got all the female imagery we could find, but we just couldn't find very much. And one suspects that society goes through cycles of smashing the female imagery and not the male imagery. And that's exactly what's happening again today with the narratives of objectification and sexualization and with anti-sex feminism. Nobody attacks erotic imagery of men. It's erotic imagery of women that comes under attack and gets smashed, in this case, smashed virtually.
Why is there this hypocrisy about the men's bodies as compared to women's bodies? I mean, is it sexist in itself against women that they're deemed to be so much more fragile and need to be protected from, you know, being seen and such?
No, I mean, I'm very much of the belief that this is in our evolutionary history. I mean, first of all, even though it's characterized as an attack on female bodies, actually, certainly this time round, this is a female campaign to suppress female imagery. This isn't right. Coming from men. I suspect that's probably been more the case in history than we've acknowledged. But from a biological point of view, and my own background is a science one, I'm fascinated with evolutionary psychology and so on. I mean, there are very, very clear evolutionary reasons why women would attack what I'm going to call, in heavy quotes, sluts. And, you know, the word today is slut shaming. Most slut shaming that we see, I know a lot of people who are porn stars and strippers and so on, it comes from other women. And the feminist narrative is that these women are obviously kind of taught to hate themselves by patriarchy, and therefore they go and attack other women who are sexually liberated. But actually, there are very, very good explanations from evolutionary psychology that explain why women would attack sexually liberated women. And I cover that in a very small way within the book. It comes down to what the definition of male and female are at the most primitive biological level. And effectively, males and females, sex has been around for about 1.2 billion years. Since then, there have been two sexes. And the difference between them is is quantitative, not qualitative. Excuse me. The female is the sex that invests most heavily in reproduction. The male is the sex that invests least in reproduction. And what that means is that, in general, females have far more sexual power have far more social power, because they control access to the most important thing, which is reproduction. You know, living things value nothing above reproduction. And that expresses itself differently in different species. But in humans, it is women that very much... Women choose mates. Men don't choose mates. Men mate opportunistically. And it is women who choose mates, which makes women incredibly powerful socially and economically. And so... You know, it comes down to sex has always been a commercial commodity. We like to think of this as some kind of horrible social construction, that prostitution is kind of made by capitalism or made by social forces. But actually, prostitution exists throughout the animal kingdom. It's not a particularly unusual thing in humans. And it's invariably, wherever you, in any species that where you find prostitution, it's males that buy sex from females, whether it's for food, for services, for protection, or whatever. And so women have a lot more to lose from sexual freedom than men do. You know, looking around in daily life and, you know, primitive societies as well as modern societies, women control the access to sex. And men who have to work for sex. This explains many things, like, you know, men are bigger and stronger because men have to hunt, and hunting is an incredibly dangerous and horrible thing to do in the wild state. But a thing that Jared Diamond, the anthropologist and writer, wrote an essay called Why Do Men Hunt? And, you know, the answer is because... You know, we might think, oh, because the tribe needs protein or whatever. But the answer is quite simply that meat buys sex. And that's why men go out and in primitive societies and risk their life hunting. And I've written a kind of a similar essay with the title, Why Don't Women Hunt? And the answer is women don't have to hunt. You know, it's men that go out and get trampled and killed and so on.
Right.
And being a successful hunter means that you're going to reproduce more successfully.
Have you heard of this 70s? I think she was Canadian feminist, Shuli Firestone.
No, I haven't.
She was a radical socialist feminist, and in 1970s she authored a book called The Dialectic of Sex, mm-hmm. The Case for a Feminist Revolution. And what she thought was that it was women's biology, their reproductive investment, as you called it, mm-hmm. that made them the weaker sex, that made them unequal, that put them at a disadvantage in relationship to men. So her call was for science and technology to step in and relieve women of the burden of carrying children.
Yeah.
And that would create real equality. And just a little personal story before I let you comment on it. I was describing this, talking to my wife about this, and she didn't seem very thrilled by this idea. And her response was that women might, if they were in a society where reproduction was taken over by machines, that women might withhold sex. And I thought that was a strange response. But yeah, there seemed like this instinctual sort of, like, I don't like this idea response to.
Yeah, and it's a very instinctive and an honest response, because actually women do control access to sex and I think most people instinctively know that. And our reproductive roles are changing rapidly. And obviously, you know, there was a massively important change when women got the pill and an abortion, you know, in the 1960s. This changed everything, and we're still feeling the ripples from that. This was probably one of the most fundamental things that's ever changed in human beings, because for the first time, women aren't baby machines, and this is changing and will change gender roles massively. And then at the same time, automation is taking away what men do, which is the heavy stuff, you know, the heavy lifting and the dangerous stuff. So, you know, there is a massive equalization happening. And, you know, whether, you know, it looks like that we're actually having less sex than we used to. And there are lots of reasons for that. But, you know, pornography is one of those reasons. And it's kind of funny that with all of the complex narratives put around pornography, the most obvious one is ignored because it's too obvious or it's too crass or people don't like it. And that is that when men have we could say fulfilling masturbation, and certainly masturbation has become more fulfilling as we've got access to pornography, they desire sex less. And as a result, you'd expect less sex, you'd expect less sexual violence, and certainly sexual violence has been plummeting around the world in recent decades. And, you know, I think, yeah, I included a bit of science in the book because I think it's really important. And when I get involved in debates and university seminars on these subjects, it's mostly in front of a social sciences audience that doesn't know anything about evolution, and that has that's grown up with a kind of socially constructed narrative of everything. And I think it's really important that people just understand, go back to the basics of sex, what it is and why we have it, because it pretty much, once you understand the evolution of sex and how it made gender relations in humans, you can pretty much understand every aspect of human behavior. You know, there isn't very much that doesn't have a sexual element.